Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use jobs. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
This episode of the Carpcast. It is just one nod, who occasionally uses chods. Very rarely, though. Not used one this year. Not needed to. Now, Jamie is away at the minute. He's in Las Vegas. He's trying to win his fortune at the poker table. He's actually extended his holiday, and I don't think he's doing too badly at the poker. Let's see, what have I been up to? I've been fishing. I've actually covered a bit of a chunk, as some of you may have seen on the Facebook page. Now, let's tell you a little bit about that session. It was down on Hyken, where I've been having a bit of a dabble, a venue I've been associated with for a bit. I fished it on and off for 15 years or so. Seen it go through many stages, different changes. So it's always nice to go back. And with a very odd exception, it's always nice people to fish amongst and socialise with as well. Bailiff Martin is spot on. I guess down there on, when was it, I finished Sunday at work. I finished Sunday work at 2 o'clock, which means I can get a flyer to the lake, fish Sunday night and Monday night. Yeah, I have Monday and Tuesday off. That is my weekend. And I love it. It's the best time for carp fishing because all the weekenders can come do the bit. And then I get down to an empty lake usually. And at almost 200 acres, you're never going to be short for room, but it's still nice to get there and have it all to myself, because I am an unsociable sod. As I'm sure you can all relate to, I'm driving down there, I've looked at the weather, I've done my research, I know what's happened over the weekend. I've got certain areas, certain swims going round in my mind that I want to look at first. So I had a walk round an area they call the Washings, which is quite muddy, shallow in the edge. One swim I did kind of fancy, I was put off straight away. I walked into the swim, and your rods have to be out in the water, it's that shallow close in. And there's a couple of swans with cygnets taking up residence in there. Swans are evil. I am not nowhere near them. They say that the queen's bird, she can come and get them. I am not happy with them, she can come and take them away. I end up fishing this swim. I don't think it's got a name, I just refer to it as a plateau swim, because there is quite a large plateau out there. It's quite a good chuck as well. So after a short while, I've got 3 rods fished. I mean, it's shallow plateau. You know, it comes up to about 4 foot of the surface. So I had 1 rod on it, and the other 2 I put just around the sides in deeper water because it's not particularly warm. I didn't think they'd be getting right up on there. The plateau is basically a shallow area on quite a long, pronounced bar. I knew, at least I thought, the fish would be in the area. Spawned a bit of bait out, put a 4th rod down in the edge, and watched the water. Didn't see anything through the evening. I was up early morning, watched, saw one so far out. It was basically a decoy. I may as well have not seen it. But that morning, it was cold. When I say cold, I mean for June, it was absolutely bitter. I could see my breath. That should not be happening in June. I had my usual fishing trousers on. I put my waterproof over trousers on just for an extra layer. I've got 2 t-shirts, 2 hoodies and a big thick fleece on. I'm still not really warm. Cereal drinking brews. I had my breakfast. Some crumpets done in the Diablo, which if you've not tried, just do it. Remember, if you're doing crumpets, you cannot eat them until you have put so much margarine on that it is dripping through the bottom. That's the way to do it. And I think it was my old mate Mark Hoggs suggested do them in the Diablo first off. You do them on a slow heat, it gets them to about 100 degrees centigrade from top to bottom all the way through. That's how you eat them. It was probably the first time I've moved off the end of a cold wind in June. But I did. Went for a walk round, reassessed the situation, and plumped in a swim right on the other side of the lake. It's a swim I did fish a couple of weeks back. I had a bit of a lead around, and I knew out there was a bit of silkweed and eelgrass out there. what the sailing club have done to the lake for the past couple of years, they've added some mad green dye to the lake, which the water is still clear down to about 4 or 5 foot, and then it's just kind of like a turquoise green. It looks like lime juice. Now, they've done this to stop the Canadian weed growing, so basically so they can hold the sailing races, because it does get choked. It is worked, probably a bit too well. There's still siltweed and eelgrass out there, and I knew this swim had quite a lot of it. And in a lake where there is very little weed, if you've got weed in front of you, just fishing it. I was fishing just over the weed as I pulled the marker back into it. I was fishing just over the back. That was on two rods. This is the two I'm going to concentrate on and tell you about. Now, I was fishing four. The right-hand rod was down the margin of an island in about 6 foot. It landed with a bit of a clunk. A friend of mine, Lee, has given me some bait to play around with. It reminded me of the old monster crab I used years ago. That didn't do anything, unfortunately. The next rod, I'd spread around 200 baits around, and that was plonked in the middle of them with just a snowman matching the freebies. Now, one of my favourite tactics that's caught me a lot of fish, my next rod, was a single white pop-up about a rod length off it, off the baited area. And in this case, that was a dynamite monster tiger nut pop-up. Not only is it a cracking bait, the colour of it, it's got that like washed out dull white. I do quite like that. And the next rod, I know there is some lumps and bumps quite some distance in that swim. I'd had a quick lead around, felt the lead land on one, clipped up and put a single bright pink almond pop-up on it. Again, a hook bait that I have caught a few fish on in the past. That was that. Here's a little top, because they are a tip, because they are pop-ups that have been soaked for quite a while in the almond goo. When you've been messing around with the almond goo that stains your fingers, don't pick your nose straight afterwards, because you end up looking like a bit of a tit. I've learned that lesson. Midnight that night, I was awake, put the kettle on, having a nice hot chocolate, because I'm old and knackered and that's what I do. I got a few bleeps on the rod, on the white pop-up just off the baited area. My first reaction was, oh, here comes Mr. Bream. I just got my first foot into my welly and then it absolutely melted off. It was the proper run from hell. It was like Beelzebub himself had picked my bait up and was off on one. I gets out there, looks into this fish, and it gave me quite a run around, to be honest. It wasn't fast, but it was strong. It gave me the typical big fish fight, you know, slow, dogged. I know the weed situation in that swim, the weed is out there, but it's not too bad, so I could just take my time and get it in the net. The swim is also pitch black. I had seen the fish turn a couple of times as it nears the net under the head torch, and I'm thinking, that's a bit of a fat one. In the net it went first time, and it was a nice fat one, so secured the net, got the cradle, the weighing retention sling, the scales, everything sorted. Oisted her up on the scales, she went just over 32 pound. Well, please, that's actually my first capture from the lake this year, so the carp gods, which I'll come to in a bit, smiled on me that session. It was also a fish I've actually got a bit of history with. A cast was mine back long, long time ago, when I first fished Icombe, there was very, very few carp in there. I think we knew of 5 or 6 mirrors, not many more commons. A few of us anglers and the sailing club who ran the fishing, and do again now, got together. We had a bit of a fundraiser. Jeff Crawford and Gary Bays kindly agreed to do a slideshow for us, and we raised a few quid. The sailing club chucked a few quid in, and we bought 26 Simos. It may sound like a drop in the ocean, and it literally was, but this 32 was one of those fish. And I think my role on that evening of the fundraiser, I just got pissed and bullied people into buying more raffle tickets. But it worked. I actually do have pictures of that fish when it was stocked at about 3 or 4 pound. To be holding it up once it's reached 30, then it's given me a good old tussle. It does put a smile on my face. I mean, at 32 pound, it's not a monster nowadays in the general scheme of things. And you pick up any magazine and there's 30s and 40s and even 50s all over the place. It gets back to the same thing. It is all relative to where you're fishing and personal satisfaction. The day I stop thinking a 20-pound carp is a big fish is the day I pack it all in and go and buy myself some golf bats. Regular listener of the Carpcast Cletus has noticed, probably by the remote in my hand, that I had done self-tape pictures of it. I'm never going to proclaim to be an expert on photography, but I can tell you what I do and what I use. My camera's a Canon 600D. Which is perfect for self-takes. It has a flip-round screen. The little remote you can see in my hand is actually an RC1 unit, although I've had a quick look online and it seems to not be available anymore. It's an RC6 that seems to be the one. This is how I do it. Once I've got the fist secured in the net or in the retention sling, I get everything sorted, because it is practice and preparation that makes your self-take spot on. You can also see at the bottom of the picture the top of my cradle. I use a cradle to line up the shots. I have a practice on the bank, take quite a few shots, and that is the beauty of the digital cameras we all have nowadays. We can take as many practice shots to get it framed right, to get the flash levels light if we're at night, as I was, and just delete the crap ones. Once we've got it right, all we need to do is get the fish out and click away. Because once we've got the fish on the bank, we don't want to be messing around with the camera. What I do when actually taking the pictures, I hold the remote in whichever hand is going to be under the fish's head. I trap it between my thumb and my first finger, which leaves all my hand, and I've got great big hands, it's like shovels. I've got fingers like Cumberland sausages. So I can get all the way around the fish, and the fish doesn't come into any harm. The biggest fish I've actually done self-takes with is 38 pounds. So what I can say in conclusion on self-takes, practice. Even if you've got a bit of a quiet time on the bank in between fish, just practice getting your setup right and taking pictures of yourself without a fish, or just hold the pillow off your bed chair as the fish to practice framing. Because as long as you get the head and tail of the fish, the belly of the fish, and your head in the shot, you framed it right. It doesn't even matter nowadays if you're a little bit further out. You can crop the image. Digital is brilliant. A lot better than when I used to use the prepaid slides. Let's have a look what else we got. What is on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Well, there's only one story on the net that seems to be dominating at the minute, and that is the conviction of Miles Gibson for illegally fishing Tatton Mere and having the audacity to catch a great big fat 52-pound common. Who wouldn't want one of those? But what we're going to do, I think we're going to leave this until next time round, because it's a venue that Jamie is very familiar with, and I'm sure he's got quite a few opinions of it himself. So it also gives us time. I think I'm going to contact the Angling Trust who have been involved for this, and I've just got a few questions for him. And also,
it's on the net. It must be true.
I see the Carp Society. Remember them? They're putting Horseshoe Lake up for sale. Now, again, this is also something we're going to do a bit more investigations on and cover in the next episode of the Carpcast, because I don't think many people are too amused with it. And I'm also seeing the unfortunate spectre of fish deaths appearing, this time on the Roach Pit, which holds some absolutely stonking old English fish. Again, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but that is something we are going to get deep into next time on the Carpcast. Got time to do a bit of research and, well, get his facts right. Maybe speak to one or two people down there and find out exactly what's been going off. So, I can guarantee you, the next episode of the Carpcast, especially if we can get the guests we want, that was guests, plural, is going to be one not to miss. Jamie will be back, he'll be able to tell us all about his poker exploits, but for now, let's get on to my special guest for this time round. And so, on short notice, I might add, I'd like to say thanks and welcome to the Carpcast, Ed Betteridge. How's it going, Ed?
Not too bad, mate, not too bad. Yeah, it's a bit busy at the minute, like it always is, everything's going all right. I'm catching the odd fish, and everything's good.
Yeah, I've seen on your Facebook you've been catching quite a few commons as well.
Yeah. Well, I've got two waters on the go, and it's literally just full of commons. You know, it's a rarity to catch a mirror. I suppose you're looking at something like 4-1 commons to mirrors. So yeah, pretty much everything I'm catching is a common, really.
Yeah, it's quite a ratio, because I remember a few years back, I took my PB mirror to, you know, over 40, but the commons, I was stuck at 28. I just never fished anywhere with them in. Everything was mirrors. It was the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm exactly the same. And I went and started fishing the Neen Valley, going after my first 40-pound common. Well, you know, it's like when you're fishing an area, sort of one water leads onto another water. And I've just found myself in recent times just fishing up and down the Neen, sort of from Peterborough to Northampton, and everything I seem to be going after at the minute is commons to any sort of size.
Yeah, there's so many lakes up and down that Neen Valley. It's like, you know, up and down the Great Ouse as well. There's a lifetime of carp fishing down there. You're spoilt for choice.
Yeah, there's a lot of water to go up, a lot of water. And, you know, a new one seems to be springing up all the time. You know, it's waters that I've heard about, you know, a good few years back, and, you know, they've got half decent fish in it. All of a sudden, they've got a handful of 40s, and you think, well, that's coming on. That's another one I need to keep an eye on. And then another one will spring up, and, you know, before you know it, you've got, you know, dozens or so waters that are on your radar that you won't mind fishing. So, yeah, it's difficult trying to keep abreast of everything and trying to work out which water's going to spring through and be that next big fish water.
Too much time and, too many waters, too many carp and not enough time.
Yeah, it is really, yeah.
Are these waters you can name or the publicity issues with them?
The one in Northampton I can't really name. The biggest fish in there is called Tyson. I think that's been publicised a little bit, which was actually out this morning. 49.9 I think it was. So that's a big old kipper.
That's a big old kipper.
Yeah, I need to get on that, I think, and try and get that one ticked off, because I've had the second and third biggest out there now, and two or three of the other sort of big ten that are in there. So yeah, I'd like to get the big one out of the way. But it's a cracking fish. It's a stunning common. It's probably not far behind the sort of Burfield common sort of looks wise. You know, it's that classically formed big golden common.
Yeah, that. But you had a bit of a dabble on Burfield the other year, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I did a couple of years on there. Yeah, really enjoyed my time. It was great fun. It was one of them places where I just sort of ended up on, really. I went on to St Ives. You know, I had the plan of being on there for two or three years. And of course, the lady died, which was a big shame. I was lucky enough to see her on the bank for the first time at 57, which was a colossal sort of weight.
She was. I'm biased, but she's
Yeah, well, you did well to catch it, mate. It's one of them fish that, you know, quite a few good anglers have struggled to get over the years.
Yeah. So, I also know a few people who nailed her on the first night.
Well, they always used to say 3 nights or 3 years, didn't they, for the lady?
Yeah.
On my third night on there, I managed to get into, you probably know the lake better than me, I only did a few nights on there. Is it Fatty's Point?
Yeah, I know the one.
I managed to get a couple of PVA bags, solid PVA bags, into Fatty's Cove. Just off the island.
Chuck.
Yeah, it is a bit of a whack, but, you know, I've done a lot of long-range fishing at Stoneacre, so, you know, I was used to working to the horizon. So, yeah, I got a couple of bags there, sitting there, and then I just looked up a few hours later, and there's like this big inner tube just seemed to have popped up right over my spot. And I was like, what the hell's that? And I was on the phone, to a mate at the time, Martin Wassell, and I just said, something's just popped up. And he says, yeah, what it will do in a minute, it will kick its little tail and sink back down. I says, why, what is it? He says, that's the big girl. Says, is it? Says, yeah, that's the big, and it does that. It just comes up to the top, floats up there and just has a little kick of its tail and goes down. Yeah, I mean, you probably saw that with your time on there. I don't know.
I saw it once or twice. There's nothing even close to do that in that thing. It was only that fish.
Yeah, it just looked like an inner tube. At first, I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a fish that was in trouble. One of the fish were a bit poorly at the time. I can't think what it was called now. One of the linears.
Bob's,
that was it. It was seen to be lying on its side and not looking too good, so I thought it might have been that's rocked up dead. Obviously not, it was a lady just getting a bit of breath, I think, before it kicked back down to the bottom. So I thought I had a chance after my third night, but it wasn't to be.
No, I think she was just that big and that shape. She wanted to, you know, nut out properly and sink back down, but she just couldn't.
So she was floated up to the top for a little while. But yeah, when she died, that left me in a bit of a loose end, and I was sort of desperately scrambling around for a water to get on. And, you know, I looked at a few places like Pingewood and made a few phone calls to try and get on a few syndicates and find out where they was, because, you know, I must admit I was a little bit out of the loop. When I was fishing Stoneacre, I was just fishing Stoneacre, and then there was... It was Lynch Hill. Obviously, Christchurch is on the same complex. And, you know, I knew if I had the lady, if I knew if I had Choco, which was my main target fish, I could always pop down onto Christchurch and finish the year off on there. And then I had St Ives as my sort of next one to move on to. So moving on to St Ives, I'm thinking I probably had a couple of years on there. And then she died. I was just a bit lost, really. So I ended up going back, well, a mile or so up the road onto Fendrayton. That place went a little bit wrong when it all flooded and, you know, a few of the big ones disappeared. I was scrambling around and I ended up on Burfield. Yeah, it's certainly a very interesting water. Have you ever walked around it?
I've never had a walk around. I've looked at it on Google Earth and it looks like quite a walk as well.
Yeah, it is. And that's kind of what I loved about it, because there was three or four different car parks and you could just sort of walk and get lost. And what I used to do is used to use at least three of the car parks, park up in one, have a look around that sort of area, sort of up Mouldy Point, Bomb Point, No Carp Bay, Weedy Bay, Snaggy Bay and Pingewood Point and all that sort of area. If I saw nothing there, I'd like back in the car round to the other side, have a look around Telegraph Bay and, you know, sort of by Speedboat Point, and then if there was nothing there, and up down the murder swims, back in the car again and drive round up the Dogleg sort of area and have a look up and down there. Yeah, there was just so much water you could explore. And the amount of times I did a couple of circuits just driving from one car park to another and just walking around the lake, just looking and looking and looking and trying to find these fish, it was, you were just exhausted by the end of the day, and you just sort of collapsed in a heap in a swim and flick your rods out, and you just had it. But it's just a great place to fish. It's phenomenal. And that fish, it's probably about the best one still around these days, I think.
Yeah, I've got to agree. I mean, when we're doing the big carp top trumps, that was the record score, the top trump.
Did it? Nice.
Yeah.
How many points? Can you remember?
I think it was something like 48 out of 50 or something ridiculous like that. It beat the Black Mirror.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another one that was sort of top of the tree. And I wish I had a little dabble four back in the day, but you know, obviously it's not around anymore.
No, it's a shame. They don't live forever, unfortunately.
No.
What was the stock in Bergfield around about the time you were fishing?
I used to hear different rumours about what stock was, and nobody actually realised. Some people said less than 100, other people reckoned they were about 250. I think the truth lay somewhere in between. I think it was something like 120 to 150 fish, something like that, maybe closer to 120. They did have a habit of, well, I found a few dead on the banks. Our little furry friends were in there for a short time because it's right near the river, and they popped over. They certainly had one from what I heard, maybe another one, but there's that many islands on there. You don't know, you know, what fish they're having, because they can quite easily just pick up a fish and drag them onto an island. You know, I think it's 30 islands on there, so you just don't know, really.
No chance of protecting them either.
No, you can't fence it, mate. It's 90-odd acres, and it's broken up into so many little bays and channels and islands, and right near the river, you just can't do it. And plus, there's a couple of houses on one bank, and there's you know, a bit of a boating club as well that you've got to give access to. There's just no way on earth that you'd fence it, even if you had all the money in the world. You just couldn't. But I don't think they're a huge problem on that. But I've got no doubt they will pop over from time to time. But I still think the vast majority of the fish are in there.
Well, we know about the big common, which I believe the last time, last time I know of it coming out was Dave Lane at 55.
Yeah.
What other, you know, big notable fish? Well, they're all notable, but what other, you know, 40 pluses in there? Is there many of them?
Yeah, I think there's a few. The tiger fish always used to be the second biggest when I first started on there. Rumours are rife about what's happened to that fish. I don't know if that's in there anymore, to be honest. That used to be a fairly regular visit to the bank once or twice a year, so I'm not sure where that is. But others are sort of springing up to take its place. There's a cracking sort of almost linear that Dave Lane had at 44. I know that fish has done 46 in the past, under the radar a little bit. There was a 45 came out there 3 or 4 years ago that's not really been seen since, but I don't think that was a regular visitor either. And then there's probably about 10 or 12 40s at the right time of year. When I say right time of year, I mean right time of the year, because one minute they can be 40 and the next minute they can be 34, you know. And yeah, there's certainly one fish that I had. I mean, Daryl Peck had it at 42 and I recognised it straight away as a fish I had at 36. There's another one that did 41 that I had at 34. I can go down the list. Just looking at my pictures and other people's pictures that have caught them at the right time of year, and I think I've had five fish that have done 40 in there at one point or another. So there is a few 40s, but they're very, very seasonal fish.
Yeah. What about the common, the big girl? Is that a female?
Everybody used to think it was a male, right up to the point where Terry Hearn caught it 4 or 5 pounds down in weight. I think Terry had it a couple of ounces under 48. I think it was 47, 14 or something like that. So up until that point, it had only done 5 out of 6 catches in its life. And it was always a fairly consistent weight, you know, just slowly putting on the weight year after year. And everybody just assumed it was a male. And it's you know, you sort of look at the fish, and it looks like the shape of a male. But then Terry Hearn caught it down in weight, so now people seem to think it's a female. I mean, don't get me wrong, there could have been something wrong with it. It could have been Terry, it could have been ill. And that's why it dropped the weight. I don't know. I don't know, mate. There's not enough history about the fish, to be honest. I mean, even now it's only done 10 catches.
That's mad. I'm just going by the pictures I've seen over, because when you look at, obviously, Terry Hearn's picture down in weight, compare it back to a few years earlier on Nigel Sharp's picture, it looks fit to burst.
Yeah, it does. It does look pretty fat.
I mean, imagine, because Dave Lane's picture at 55, again, it doesn't look fat. Mm. Imagine if that's a spawned out weight.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of weights been quoted on if it comes out at the right sort of time of year. I mean, Dave Lane, I think he caught it in August. It might have been July, but it could have been August. Oz, when he had it on the previous capture, pretty sure that was July or August as well. It's certainly a summer capture. You sort of look at it on that evidence, and if it is a female, and if it has spawned out, and then I'd say another 4 or 5, 6 weeks to put the weight back on, you sort of think, well, what the hell could that be if it come out October, November time?
Wow, that's... Well, who wouldn't want one of those on the string, put it that way?
Yeah, it was. It's a big old kipper, but it's never been out twice in a year before. It's only ever sort of done one capture a year, and it's quite often misses a year as well. I mean, it was a good 2 years between Dave's capture and the previous capture, so it's just not a very common fish to come out.
Yeah, was it an easy fish to find? Did you see it in the water much?
I saw it definitely once. I saw it on a few other occasions, just saw a big shadow sort of ghost underneath me rod tips or ghost past, and it sort of made me wonder. But there was sort of one occasion where I saw it, and it was, the light was on it, and I saw it from a few different angles and even got a little bit of video footage of it. Yeah, it was definitely that fish. You know, even the locals that don't tend to give a lot away just says, yeah, it was her. The trouble is, when I fished it, things were changing a little bit, and my sort of second year on there, my first full year, it was restricted to how much you could fish. So the sort of dogleg area where she used to get seen and used to get caught all the time was now very much pressured. And there was a big chunk of the rest of the lake that just wasn't. And there's a little cut through, probably about 60, 70 yards, that separates the dogleg and probably 20 acres from 70 acres. And that's when Permanent had anglers in. It was a perfect cut-off point. And, fish, they've got to come past that point if they're going to get from one side to another. And with people fishing it permanently, I think the fish were just reluctant to come through there, especially with tight lines going across to the far bank. And I just don't think she got down to the areas where you were likely to see her. So I didn't see her as much in my time on there as what some of the guides had seen her in previous times, when she was a bit more natural and preferred those sort of haunts when she was a bit unpressured.
Yeah, it's like any car. When there's lines in an area, it's constantly pressure. They're going to avoid it, especially when they've got so much water they can be safe in.
Oh, definitely. I remember... When I first got on there, on my second year on there, I'd just been down Rockford fishing down there for a few weeks, and it just got so busy in the end. You just couldn't move. Once you were in a swim, that was it. You was in that swim. And there was just so many anglers on there. And, I can remember looking out my bivvy one day, and I was on like an elongated point, and looked straight down the point, and there was me at one side of the point, and I could just see four TV aerials sticking out the bivvies at the rest of the point. You just thought, right, well, they're not going anywhere anytime soon. You just got frustrated because you couldn't walk. Well, you could walk around, but there's no point in walking around because it was that busy. And the fish were just running scared to the centre, out of the way of all the pressure. So then for me to get onto Burfield, all of a sudden it was really quiet. I think it was me and two bailiffs on there, or two bailiffs and another angler on there. And it was really quiet down there. It was just nice to get sort of away from all the pressure, away from all the hassle, and back to nature. I was fishing this point called Hodder's Point, which is one hell of a walk. You sort of walk through the dogleg area, knock all these stingers out of the way, get stung bit and everything else, and they pass that overgrown, that it's all the branches are coming in on you. You have to unload your barrow twice because there's two big dips, and you have to get over a fallen tree. It's just one hell of a trek, and you just get into the swim absolutely collapsed. But once you're there, you're sort of out of the way of everybody a little bit. There was a few fish in that area as well. I counted at least a dozen fish messing around, and I got a couple of fish feeding right in close, and I was just watching them down the side of this point, and I still had a couple of rods out, I say quite long, probably about 50, 60 yards, fishing up against this other island, and I was watching the fish down the right-hand side of the point, and got them feeding on a little bit of bait, and just had my stalking rod on them, and they were coming up and over the shallow gravel in front of me, which is about 18 inches deep, and I can remember one fish came over, this shallow bit of gravel, went down, went sort of towards me other rod tips where my line was in the water, saw this sort of, I'm going to say tight line, but it was sort of semi-slack line coming down and going out into the pond, and it just turned and bolted, and I watched this bow wave just go 80-odd yards and disappear around the corner of the island, and I just thought, well, what chance have you got in a big lake if the fish are that spooky off lines? It was just phenomenal. I've seen that happen a good few times on small waters where they know every inch of their environment. But for that to happen, and it happened a few times with a few different fish, in such a big lake like that, you just think, God, everything's against you on here. It's just phenomenal, really. You know as well as me, I suppose you fished a few big waters, and normally the fish in big waters aren't as spooky as a fish in small waters.
No, not at all. You can take liberties with them, like tight lines.
Usually. Well, these Burfield fish, they were clued up about that, and that really surprised me.
Did you ever go for the colder months on there, or...?
I fished well into November. The plan was to fish into sort of the first week of December, because I had a baited spot going. But I had a night where I wasn't particularly well on the bank. Yeah, it kind of scared me a little bit. And basically what happened was I'd done the first night on there. I was getting my stuff together the first morning. And I think I just packed my bivvy up, moved a few things around a little bit, and I found myself short of breath. Cut a long story short, my heart was going a bit funny. I thought, I'll be all right, you know. I thought, I'll be all right, I'll be fine. I'll just sit this one out a little bit and sat it down, got my breath back. I'm fine. I said, yeah, I'll do another night. It's all right, I'm on fish. So that night, I was just lying in bed and my heart was all over the place. It was like one really strong beat and then miss a beat and then two little murmurs and one real bang. And I was like, yeah, this ain't good. I should not be on the bank like this. And I started thinking, what should I do? Should I drive myself to hospital? But I thought, no, my kit's on the bank and there's no way I've got the energy to pack it up. So I thought, I'll wait this one out. And yeah, slowly packed up the following morning, drove myself home. The missus made me go to hospital and I had an aortal flutter. My heart had sort of gone out of sync a little bit.
That's so, scary stuff, especially when you're somewhere like Bergfield no one's going to hear you scream out, are they?
No, especially when I was in a swim just up from the murder swims. Yeah, it's sort of any thought of leaving your tackle when you've got swims like that next door to you, you think, nah, it's a bit dodgy down here, I'm not doing that. So yeah, basically cut a long story short, they sort of knocked me out and electrocuted my heart back into rhythm. And then the following week I'm getting my kit together and everybody, all my family sort of says on their certain terms, I ain't going fishing. Which they were right to say, to be fair, but I wanted to go down because I had a spot rocking and rolling. So no, I think I only made it into the second week of November and I was still catching. So I'd have liked to have carried on a little bit longer, but I couldn't really. And once I'd stopped for a couple of weeks, my baited spot would have subsided. So I'd have lost all momentum really. So there's no point going back.
I see what you mean. But there's another word I want to pick your brains about. You've just mentioned Stone Acres.
Yeah. Interesting lake.
What was that? It was Bite Mark and Choco were the two there. Was that when you were fishing?
Yeah. When I joined, it was all about Choco. I think Choco had just done 50 for the first time. And Bite Mark wasn't really mentioned. I suppose it was around the sort of 42. Maybe just on 42 when I first got my ticket. It's 44 when I just got my ticket. So it wasn't really a massive target fish for me. But it was one of those that slowly put on weight in the time I was there. And it did become an important fish toward the ends, and I think it's probably the biggest fish in there now, because I don't think Choco's there anymore.
Has Bite Mark done 50?
Yeah, he did 50 on a couple of occasions, yeah. Certainly two occasions that I know of. I've lost track with it a little bit since I've left there. I pulled off in there back in 2010. I'm not sure what weights it's done since then. I think it's done a 48 and a 49. But I don't know if it's done 50 again or not. I'm not entirely sure. It's a big old fish. It's a chunk of a fish as well. And that's another one that we thought was a male, because it was doing sort of constant weight gains throughout the years, and slowly creeping up there. You know, it's doing, as I said, 42, 44, 46, 47. And then it did, I think it ended up at nearly 48 pounds. Went on the missing list for a year, then all of a sudden come out at 40 pounds on the nose.
It's had a good blowout then.
Yeah, either had a good blowout, or it wasn't very well, or it was tethered or something, but something caused it to drop all that weight. And then it went on the missing list again, and I caught it one night. And I can remember looking at it in the net and thought, that's Bite Mark. And I sort of look at it and think, well, how big is it? What could it be? You know, it's last out at 40, but he's done 47 in the past. And I can remember when Kev Wilson had it and seen his pictures at 46, it looked quite fat. And I was thinking, well, it's not as fat as that. So it must be 44, you know, something around that, somewhere between 40 and 46. And then I tried to lift it out. And thought, that weighs a pretty good weight. And it rocked scales around to 48.6. Yeah. And it, like I say, it was nowhere near as fat as what I'd seen in the past. So it had literally just grown in its frame and got bigger, and it just got a bigger fish all in all. So yeah, it was, and that's a stunning fish, lovely fish, the colours to it, and you know, a couple of little pinpick scales near its tail, and then that one big sort of C-shaped scale towards its back end. It's a cracker, that one is, absolutely cracking fish.
Yeah, there's one fish that I always catches my eye when I see pictures out from there. You have to correct me, is it called the number 9 bus?
Yeah. Yeah, I had that fish twice. It's just the pure length of it. It's just unbelievably long. It's
a linear to boot.
It's a linear. It's almost a double linear in places. Well, treble linear in places. It's just a cracking fish. It was one of the first fish I had out there. I joined back in 2007. I got a late ticket sort of around June time. And by the time I got on there, the fish and stone acreage spawned out. I thought, well, let's give that a miss for a little while. Let's have a look at the two other lakes on the complex in the summer. And I just ended up fishing Willow because I just loved Willow. The fish in there are nowhere near as big as the fish in Stoneacre or the fish in Christchurch, but the fishing on there at the time was all margin fishing, you know, the big overhanging trees. The fish took themselves right in at the edge, and they were coming out in floaters as well. So I just used to spend the days either with two rods tucked either side of the margins or going around stalking for them with a rod out in the centre just doing a bit of floater fishing. It was all my kind of fishing, all visual. You know, you're going back to the hunter style of fishing rather than the trapper style of fishing. So I didn't get on Stoneacre until September, and I managed three fish out in September, pulled off for the winter, and then went back on in the spring. And I think I timed it just right in the spring because all the fish were just started getting caught, and it really does sort of back end of April, start of May, turn into silly season on there. They were all coming out from one quarter of the lake, literally just they were just getting caught left, right and centre, and every little gap you can possibly imagine on there, there was somebody in it. I think there was something like seven people, maybe a few more actually, just fishing every little gap in this one end of the lake. And I thought, I don't really want to be part of that. You know, I don't want to sort of step in there and ruin somebody else's fishing. You know, I'm still quite new to the lake. So I thought, I'm just going to get away from it all a bit, go for the centre of the lake. There's a big clear spot that I'd put a little bit of bait in previously when I was fishing the same lake on the complex. So I just dropped in there. I'm pretty sure it was my first bite. It was certainly on the first session back. It was the number 9 bus at £39. Absolute cracking fish.
Wow, good scrap.
It wasn't a mental scrap like you'd think of a fish sort of that size. And I know a few people that said it literally just coming like a tench, but it gave up a bit of a scrap for me. Managed to land it from the bank. It went on several sort of powerful runs, and I could just remember bringing it over the landing there, and I just kept bringing it over. I thought, it's still not in yet. And then managed to scoop it up, and it must be 3.5 foot long. It's a ridiculously long fish.
Yeah, I would have thought a fish as long as that would have towed you around a bit.
Yeah, I would have thought so as well. But like I say, it put up a decent scrap for me. And the second time, I got in a right mess with it. Yeah, basically, I hooked it from quite close in, about 40 yards out on this spot that I've been baiting. And it weeded me up straight away. I had it a bit later in the year. I had it in September. Because it weeded me up, I went out in a boat after it, and it just decided to plough up and down right in front of my swim. So I picked up another line, and this other line sort of crept up the line, went over the top of the rod, ended up sort of around my neck, and I was tangled up in it. It was a right old mess all the time. My alarm was screaming off, and I think annoying everybody on the lake until somebody finally come around and switched it off for me. But it was just one of them scenarios. I couldn't do anything. I was out in the boat playing this fish, and this other line was you know, just going everywhere. But I managed to get it in the boat, pitch black, because I don't like playing fish with head torches on, even out, more especially out in the boat, because you just end up spooking the whole swim. And I can just remember in the boat, netting it, reaching down and feeling it in the net, and I thought, well, that's one of two fish, that is. That's either the number 9 bus or another fish called Gold Shoulder, which is equally just as long and thin. Yeah, I got it back into the bank, and it was down in weight. It was at 37, but it was still a stunning fish.
Oh, definitely. You're not going to shake them off at any weight when they're like that.
No, that's it. I mean, I don't really like recaptures as such because you're sort of taking it off somebody else, but it's always nice to see them again and, you know that they're well and they're fighting well and they're in good condition.
Now, you mentioned using boats on there. Was it all boat work or...?
When I was on there, it was a strange rule. Not strange rule, it's a pretty good rule, actually. I quite liked it. It meant you could use the boat to find your spots because the water was crystal clear. You know, the deepest bit in there was about 13 foot, and on a sunny day, you could see right down to 13 foot. You could see every bait on the bottom. But a lot of the fishing, especially through the spring and summer, was all on the bars and on the gravel, or it was for me anyway. I'd go out there in a boat, find the spots I wanted to fish, a couple of H blocks down, or more. Well, what I used to do is three H blocks. So say I wanted to fish on a bar or a big clear spot, I'd put one at the back of the spot, two towards the front of it, either side, and then you sort of go back to the bank and then try and put your left sort of in between the three, knowing you're on the clear spot, because you had to cast from the bank. You couldn't tow your rigs out like you can do now, but then you could go back out and bait up again from the boat. So it just ensured that nobody was really sort of towing baits all over the place, because you know, as soon as you've got a water where you can tow bait from, you've got sort of five or six swims that just control everything. You know, you lose your little corners and stuff because you can quite easily just tow a rig down to a corner or tow a rig across at an angle and put it in front of another swim. So I quite like that rule because it meant you had to have a degree of skill for casting out and hitting the spots and making sure everything was, you know, was nice and untangled on the spot. You know, I used to spend a hell of a lot of time casting, getting the baits in the right place, going out with a boat with a glass bottom bucket and having a look at the rigs, making sure they were smack on the spot and untangled, which was a huge thing. You know, you wouldn't believe how many times you'd go out there and your rig was either tangled or had a poor lie or sitting up in the weed or you know, just looked awful. I had quite a few occasions where it'd go out there, it'd crack down with a thud, and then I'd go out in the boat thinking that's landed sweet on the spot, that is. And you sort of look, and fair enough, your lead has cracked down on the gravel, but then your whole rig is suspended up when it's caught a piece of Canadian weed on the way down and you're fishing 8 inches off the deck. And, you know, it sort of really opens your eyes to think, well, how many times does this happen when I'm not going out in the boat and checking? It really does play with your mind a little bit sometimes.
Yeah, you've played with my mind now. All these doubts in I thought I'd got rid of years ago.
Well, I've gone away from lead corn, away from sort of just fishing fluorocarbon straight through or using thin leaders to going back to tubing, because the tubing's the stiffest, thickest material out there, and that's the material you're least likely to get a tangle on. And the amount of times I went out in the boat, looked over the side and saw the rig was tangled, then went back to the bank, wound the rod in, and the tangle had straightened itself. So if you were sitting there over that rod for 24 hours thinking that smack on the money and fish crashing all over you, why aren't it going? Well, the answer is it was probably tangled or hung up in a piece of weed or something's not quite right with it.
Yeah, that is interesting. Now, with all these things you've seen, is there any rig or anything you came up with to eliminate them, or were you just correcting them after seeing them in the boat?
I started off going on there with just a coated braid rig. I was just using a double hook bait rig, and that seemed to work fine for me, but it did have a tendency of tangling a little bit. So, yeah, I did adapt things, and that's when I started using the hinge stiff rig. It was nowhere near as popular as it is now, and I don't think a great deal of people were using it. I know Terry Earn started using it way before then, but he was using it sort of, as far as I understand it, 2 to 3 inches off the deck, using amnesia and, you know, with it being quite a crude rig. I didn't want to pop up anywhere near that, fishing that high. I wanted it, you know, an inch off the deck, if that. I just wanted it sitting, so it just present a very neat little bit of debris, but it wouldn't sort of sit up on gravel and be blatantly obvious. So that's when I came up and started using that rig. I started adapting things a little bit more and changing things with it and changing things around. I started using it with a lead clip system. A lot of people used to use it with helicopters and swear by it with helicopters. And then if they did use it with a lead clip, they'd use it with a ring swivel, so they had that degree of movement. But in order for me to minimise tangles, I used it straight off the lead clip and put a sort of anti-tangle sleeve over that, so it would kick it out even more. Now, if that landed in any sort of soft bottom or any sort of weed, it did mean it would kick the rig straight up in the air, but it would stop tangles in the fly. And if I landed on the gravel that I wanted to be fishing on, then I knew pretty much it'd be untangled and it'd be sitting well. So, yeah, I changed things around there, and I did sort of quite far on the side of caution not to get tangles, and that's something I've taken away with me. You know, especially going on to fish in Christchurch after that, and I was just so paranoid about tangles, knowing full well I couldn't go out in the boat and check if it was tangled or not.
Yeah, certainly given me something to think about there, because years back I'd always be paranoid about tangles. And then you get to a stage where you've got no worries about bait, you know your rigs work, and my rigs are pretty much what you've described, and I'm thinking, are they tangling, even though I'm bringing them in straight?
Yeah, I mean, I've even the stiffest material I've had fret back on itself and fret round the lead and tangle up. I'm of the opinion that, you know, if your rig's tangled out there, probably less than 50% you actually wind in tangled. You know, I think by the time it's come in, especially if it's caught a bit of weed on the way in, will sort of unfrap itself and straighten itself out. So I'm always fishing rigs that I know or fairly confident aren't going to tangle, you know. You know, I use a lot of, if I do use a sort of coated braid rig with a bottom bait, I'll use a stick on it, a PVA stick mix, not to add attraction or anything like that, but just to simply get the rig out there untangled.
Yeah, I'm thinking I'm just going to use solid bags from now on.
Well, yeah, you know, if you can persevere with keep tying them up all the time, then yeah, I think there is a
I'd soon get fed up of that. Especially if there's a bit of rain around.
Yeah, it's not the one, is it? And then you have to make them nice and compact, then you take them out in the rain for them to go a bit wobbly again. Yeah, it's not the one.
That's on the... What's another water you fished? Let's talk about deep water.
Mm.
You fished a couple of, well deeper than average lakes. Obviously, Elstow 2.
Yes, which I think you and Jamie have covered quite a lot in the podcast over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I think since number one, to be honest, but I spent so much time down there and had so much fun as well.
Oh, it's a cracking place, mate, and I think I met you down there once, actually, but it was sort of after your main time on there. I think you were a couple of years ahead of me, maybe 3 years ahead of me, through getting on there, and I must admit I was kind of reading your pieces as I was getting onto the place, as you do, just to gather as much information on the place as you can. And I certainly read a good few articles from yourself and Jamie, back in the days when Carp Addict were on our shelves. I know you was as a regular contributor to that.
Yeah, well, I think I had two or three articles in the first few, and then, well, we'll not go there.
I think I was the last three, and I'm not sure if I killed the magazine or not, or what happened to it, but...
It wasn't you who killed it. No, maybe me and Jamie will sometime when we're feeling a bit that way out.
Right.
I don't remember a friend telling me that I did some articles in Cart World back then as well on
it too.
One of the articles I'd drawn a bit of a map of the sunken island swim and marked the spots on, or roughly where they were.
Yeah,
I did have a friend tell me that he'd actually walked into the swim because it's quite tall, the swim, like the steep backdrop.
Yeah, it is straight down into.
He'd been stood at the back and someone's down at the bottom looking at my map and looking to see where the spots were we found.
I tell you what, I don't know if I told you the story or not, but I was down there in February. It was freezing cold, as it is in February. Not very nice. I was fishing the snag swim, and this sort of snag swim, as you know, is opposite the car park. And I'd seen somebody rock up in the car park. They sort of spied me, hopped out of the car, come around. Sure, mate. Yeah. Oh, I'm just down here for have a look around. I've just read one of Mark Watson's articles. I said, all right, have you? He says, yeah. He said, the fish feed in the edge here quite a lot. I'm just going to have a walk down, see if I can find them. And I'm thinking, February, mate. And then, sure enough, no more than 5, maybe even 10 minutes later, he rocked back. Oh, he's talking crap. There's nothing down there at all. And I'm thinking, Jesus, mate. just think about what you're saying and what you're doing. It's freezing cold. I've not seen a fish for the last two or three sessions, and you were expecting to see him in the edge straight away. Get real.
Yeah, he could have waited, till at least May.
Well, exactly, yeah. But a lot of people just don't think of these things. They just read an article. And, I find that a lot. Now, I'm writing, a fair bit. People read an article and then sort of take that as granted that that's going to be the case for, 12 months of the year. I've seen it on a few occasions where I've written about heavy baiting, or I've seen somebody has written about heavy baiting on the water that somebody's fishing, and of course they think that's the way to do it, and then rock up in February and March absolutely slowing the bait and expecting to get the same results that mate has got the summer or the autumn before, and it just doesn't work that way at all.
No, not at all, but it's all part of the learning curve, because I'll be honest, I've been there and done exactly the same thing. I'll tell you one example from years back, although this one actually worked. I remember reading a Frank Warwick article about his anchor rig. So I thought, oh, I've got to try that, I'll catch loads. I won't say loads, but I did catch quite a few on it. But then there's quite a few others that slipped my mind, but I've caught nothing on for the reasons you've said.
Right, okay, fair enough. It's the way it goes, and some people just read something and take it for granted that that's the way to do it 12 months of the year, instead of thinking about things a bit more and applying a bit more thought into the fishing. I think if people did that, then they'd catch a lot more fish, because I've done a few tutorials, as I know you have, because was there on the same course getting the qualifications. You get talking to folk on the phone and booking these tutorials, and you meet up with them on the bank and you sort of have a look through the rig box and chat to them a bit and think, well, that all looks in order, they're using a decent bait, the rig looks all right. And then you start talking to them a bit more, and it's just the watercraft that's lacking, to be honest. They talk about whaling baiting in winter and, just fishing over singles in autumn and spring and whatever else. And you think, well, yeah, you've got that a little bit wrong. You just need to work out the fish a little bit more and think about, how the fish are going to react. The cold-blooded creatures, so they're going to react to the temperature of the water. And just to fish accordingly and to take into account, you know, angling pressure and water temperature and time of year and, you know, a whole host of things that lead into watercraft, because that tends to be the single most thing that I get asked. You know, I tend to take out guys that are, or used to take out guys, I'm busy doing tutorials at the minute, but, you know, I tend to take out guys that are slightly more experienced, they've got through that sort of beginner stage and now they want to step up, and the one thing they want to learn is watercraft. And, you know, I've been asked to do watercraft features on Brasnose, and it's
kind of, I look forward to that one.
Yeah, it's sort of like, well, I'll take you around the lake and do it in theory if this was a quieter lake, but on here, you're sort of trying to get in a, you know, you just try and find two swims together, you know, that give you access to the centre of the lake and go from there. You know, the watercraft on there is essentially just sort of wandering around, have a couple of words, you know, with a few people that are fishing. You know, they'll soon point you in the right direction. And it's a case of reading through the lines a lot of the time, you know. You know, because people say, oh, that guy across there is catching. You know, he's had loads because he's in the going swim. But then you sort of work out what he's doing compared to what everybody else is doing, and it soon becomes apparent that he's not in the going swim. He's just doing it right. And there's a whole host of swims around the lake that do the fish if the angler's just fished it right. You know, I went on, you know, one particular session that I remember. It was very early April, and it was still quite cold. Everybody around the lake were just spotting to 60, 70 yards. Yet matey in the hot swim, or so-called hot swim that was catching, all he was doing was casting to 110 yards and just putting out bits of bait. You know, a couple of spots after each fish, and that was it. But, of course, everybody's queuing up to get in that swim because that's the going swim. Me and the guy I took on the tutorial, we dropped in a couple of swims down, did a bit of long-distance casting with him, got him up to casting 110, 120 yards. He had eight fish. I slung my rods out next to him. I had eight fish without even trying. And then the other, you know, because we were going after the 24 hours, there were guys in the next swim saying, oh, can we move in it after you? You know, this is the going swim. I says, look, all you've got to do is just get a bait out there to the centre. He goes, no, my baited area is at 70 yards, mate. Ignore that. Just get a single out there, you know, 110 yards, further than everybody else, and you'll catch. That's all you need to do. And he sort of walked off, shaking his head, and they never did. And they moved in behind us and blanked, by all accounts. So it's a lot of watercraft is just working out where the fish are. They're out in the centre because they're all angling pressure around the edge. They don't want a lot of bait because the water's still cold. Just get a single, just get anything out there and catch them. And, you know, that's all it is sometimes. But a lot of people don't apply that thought to what they're doing. They might have caught in autumn by doing exactly the same thing, putting a big spotted bed of bait out to 70 yards and fishing over the top of it, and that might have done them proud. But now, because they don't really want the food, they're not really coming in for the food, you've got to go in there after them and go to get into the centre of the lake.
Yeah, I mean, you've done right with the watercraft, and a lot of people, they don't look at that. They think there's something wrong with the bait or there's something wrong with the rigs, which is why they've come to that like a wall. They can't seem to get the head any further on.
Yeah, exactly. And you get a lot of people that just can't get their head around fishing in weed and fishing holes in weed and feeling for that donk down and the, you know, the difference between the soft cushion touchdown and the donk and the silt and everything else. I think a lot of people end up fishing in weed quite a lot of the time, and the rigs are sort of hung up and everything else. But there tends to be a whole host of reasons why they're not catching. It generally isn't rigs. A lot of the time it isn't bait, because, you know, they buy bait straight off the shelf, which tends to be pretty good stuff. It's just the application, where they put the rigs, how they get the rigs out, and if they're fishing in the right place or not.
Well, one session that does spring to my mind, it was on pit 5 on the A1 pits. I mean, I like going down there for tuitions because you've got options of small well stocks to larger, you know, more tricky lakes.
Mm.
We'd gone on pit 5. We'd found some fish on the back of the wind at, you know, maybe between 1,800 yards range. Got the spots baited out there, and the lad I was with, I've forgot his name to be honest, but he had a small fish in the morning, a stocky about 8-9 pound. But then the fish, as soon as the sun come up, they were back over us, not in big numbers, but then every now and then the tufties had come over. They'd dive down, and they were coming up. I got the binoculars out, and they were coming up with the boilers that we'd put in, which told me the fish may be there, but they're not eating. Right, yeah. They're moving.
Yeah.
We moved, and four fish later.
I think you do get that, and you know, I saw it on Burfield once. You know, it was a red hot sunny day in the middle of summer, and me and this other lad pretty much stumbled across a whole host of fish in a bay called Alsatian Bay, and there was a shed load of fish in there, and we sort of had a chat between ourselves, and sort of says who's going after him. I says, I tell you what, let's get a float over each, and let's both have a crack. So we both went in there with the floaters and we were whacking the bait out and getting the mixers out amongst them, and they just didn't want to know. You know, no matter where you put the mixers or how many or how few you put out there, they just weren't interested in taking them in the slightest. They were just drifting off. And, you know, we got a big bed of mixers out in the centre. And I can remember seeing three fish come cruising across in towards the mixers. And I thought, these are on the move. I bet these will have a little go at them. They all sort of disappeared. Well, certainly two disappeared, and then one popped up, and one bow waved right round this big bed of mixers, right round to the side, and picked up where he would have done before, and started swimming off. And it was joined by the other two. And what the other two had done, they'd sunk down 2 or 3 foot under, swam under this big raft of mixers, and popped back up again, and carried on going. And I just thought, well, that's it. Then they just don't want to know at all, in the slightest. You know, no matter what we do in front of these fish, they are just not going to have it. So we called it a day. Sort of wandered back to the car park, and as we passed No Carp Bay, there's a load more of the fish sitting in there. It's like, well, is there any point? Oh, well, let's fire some mixers out, and they'll pack that in. They were just having them all. And you just think, well, how come they didn't want it, and these want it? And it must have just been a different pack of fish, whether it was a different strain of fish, or a different year of fish, or just a different mentality of the fish, maybe different temperature from one bait to another, I don't know. But they just wanted the bait, whereas others didn't. And yeah, we still didn't catch. I think we had a take each that we managed to miss between us, and then the fish just sort of cottoned on that we were fishing for them and drifted off around the corner of the snags where it was nice and safe. So, yeah, it didn't really help us at all, but it just stood out in my mind that some fish would be up for it, and moments later, or moments previous, other fish wouldn't be. And it's quite strange.
Situations like that, it makes you wonder, do they communicate with each other? Do they actually talk where one of them says, come on, lads, there's some snap here, let's get in. And, you know, the ones before, one of them said, careful, lads, they're trying to catch us.
Definitely. I don't know how they do it or what they do. I think when one fish is on edge, the other fish pick up on it. You know, I'm sure animals have got different senses that other animals haven't. You know, it's like, you know, when you take a dog for a walk and you're a bit edgy about this, you know, somebody walking up the other side, you know, or if a missus takes a dog for a walk and she's a bit worried about teenagers, the dog will go snapping at them. But if a woman's coming the other way, you know, the dog won't worry. I think the fish are the same. They can pick up certain things from other fish around them, you know, quite what it is, whether it's just body language or what it is, I don't know. But, you know, you probably know as well as me that when you're watching a fish in a snag and its fins are going out and it's looking twitchy, you know it's not relaxed, and you know it's probably clocked that you're sitting there looking at it from a tree. Whereas if it's just sitting around, their legs just moving around and not really doing a great deal, you know, it probably either doesn't know you're there or doesn't care either. But I've seen it on a few occasions over the years. You know, one occasion stood out to me on Fen Drayton when I was fishing there at the time. It was basically a red hot sunny day, and I decided to go and have a look around on the back of the wind. So I hopped in the boat, just drifting the boat around, and I'd come across a couple of fish, and they'd sort of drifted off. And as I was going forward, I just saw a fin flick out, probably about 20 yards in front of me. So I just cut the engine on the boat, and the momentum just slowly drifted me up to this fish. You know, I wanted to back off a little bit and you know, get away from it and just sort of have a look at it from afar. But, you know, momentum was already going, and to do anything either meant me moving or putting the engine back on. So I just let the boat slowly drift up, and the fish sort of saw me coming towards it, and I was standing up in the boat, and it sort of flanked round, had a good look at me, sort of went on its side underneath the boat and just sort of scraped the bottom as it does, and sort of looked at me on its side, and I could see it was quite a big linear, quite a nice looking, quite a long linear actually. And then what it did, it sort of scooted around to the front of the boat, and I looked up and followed it, and there was a common in front of the boat, probably about 10 yards in front of the boat, and it sort of nudged this common in the side, and they both drifted off, as if to say, there's danger here, let's get out of it. You know, there's some big geezer and stupid out looking at us from the boat. And them two fish certainly communicated. A bit later on in that session, I was thinking, what fish was that? Because you sort of knew there was a lot of uncaughts in there, and, you know, there weren't too many linears. And I knew it wasn't the sort of long linear that was coming out on a regular basis. And the only other linear was the one that Shelley had at 48 pound. And I thought, well, it looked nothing like that. As I looked, I think I saw the front cover of Shelley's book. I don't know if I had it on the photograph, or I think I had a photograph on my phone. And I looked and I thought, that was the fish. It had that same drop scale and everything, but it was nowhere near as fat and nowhere near as big. It was probably a low 40. So when Jim had it, it must have been, you know, quite near to spawning and then spawned out completely. I'm pretty sure it was that fish that I saw. And as far as I know, I think that fish had only ever done two captures in its life. Once at 36, a couple of years before Jim had it, and then Jim had it at 48. And that, when I saw it, it was sort of 2 years after then. So I think that fish was certainly kicking around still for a good while after, certainly after its last capture. And it's a hell of a fish and one hell of a water as well.
Wow, so far, my rigs tangle and the fish tell each other to keep away from me.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. But I know this conversation sort of started on deep waters, and you know, another deep water I'm fishing at the minute is Bundes. And because of how clear the water is at the minute and the fish spend a lot of time in the edge, I've been spending a lot of time watching them and looking at them sitting in the snags and messing around and stuff. And they almost certainly do seem to communicate with each other. And if one fish is looking edgy, it can quite, you know, it can go into a group of two or three and drag those two or three off. And that's got to be some form of communication. You know, it's, like I said, I don't know how they pick up on it, but they have got a way of warning each other that there's something not quite right here, and come on, let's get out of here before something happens.
Totally agree with you, but just to move on, we're talking about Bundes, where you've been fishing.
Yeah.
You have been having a lot of fish from there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a massive advantage that I'm fishing there on a Sunday and Monday night. You know, as far as I can gather, there's been a few fish in there at the weekends. This has been my first spring on there. I've literally now just done a first year, full year. So I didn't get the ticket till late last year, and I think it was middle of June by the time I got my first session down there. So all this spring has been a little bit new for me, and they have been reacting a little bit differently to what they were last summer, but I think it's probably pressure that's causing that. I don't think the pit's been getting really busy by pit standards, but if you can imagine that a lot of the fish come out of the edge at this time of year, because it's so deep in the centre, it's as you know, it's 65 foot in the centre. And when me and you were suffering the winters back then, you know, we spent a lot of time casting into that because that's where the fish were. You know, it held its temperature a little bit more, especially sort of back end of the year. And that's where a lot of fish got caught from. But when things turn over, you know, the top layers warm up a lot quicker. So you're either catching the fish on the zigs or you're catching them out of the edge. And I'm not, you know, I'll fish zigs if that's the only option of me catching. But I do try and catch them out the edge on baits if I can. And because everybody's fishing the edge, it can make the water quite small if there's a few anglers on there. So I think there has been a few anglers on there at the weekend, and not loads have been coming out. But by the time I get down there Sunday afternoon, all they've gone. The fish have had a few hours of swimming around the lake and eating everybody's bait and doing what they want to do. So it is a fairly simple case of me rocking up and finding where the biggest pockets of fish are, or where I think the bigger fish are going to be hanging, and dropping on them and trying to catch a few. And luckily, I've done that so far. I've caught fairly consistently since March, really. So yeah, I'm quite pleased with the results I've been getting, certainly numbers wise. But I've not been catching, or certainly not felt I've been catching the sort of size of fish that I'd like to be catching on that. Yeah, there's probably around 11 or 12 40s in there. At the right sort of time, and you know, I've been trying to get amongst them, but I've so far been struggling. But saying that, this spawned, I think they must have spawned 10 days ago, and I fished it this week, and I did have one of the big gills spawn down. I ended up with one just under 33 and a 35, and those fish are generally sort of 37 and 40. So I did kind of catch a couple of the big ones that I was after in the end, but they were looking a bit tatty. You know, they were a bit battered and been throwing themselves around a bit, and they were getting, no doubt throwing themselves against the reeds and against the snags, and they were losing a scale or two. So they weren't looking in peak condition, but yeah, at least I've ticked a couple off the list.
They're still the same fish, and you know, a good blowout does them good in the long run, because when they come, you know, October, November, even on Bundes, December, January.
Oh, yeah, behooving. Yeah, big time. And those fish in there, especially the big ones, do tend to be a lot bigger back end of the year than they do when they're spawned up in May. You know, it's. I know a lot of waters where the biggest weights, and probably Burfield's one of them, where the biggest weights are actually in May when spawn bound. But those Bundes fish do like the bait, and towards the back end of the year, they are huge. And I'd be surprised if it doesn't do its first 50 this year.
Yeah, so... Yeah, you know, spring summer fishing on there. It says they're not out in the mega depths. What sort of depths are you fishing? Because I know the margins are still they're still over my head.
Yeah, it's not the swim you want, you know, not the sort of water you want to be wading in too often. Although saying that, I did fish a swim called the Swamp, where you have to put your rods in the water. But sort of one wrong step and you're in over your head straight away. It's literally, you've got a reed line and you don't tend to realise until you get onto the reed line and look downwards that the reeds are actually uncut. So you stay a good couple of foot back from the edge of the reeds, because if you go down, you're straight down to 8 foot, and it literally is straight down to 8 foot, and then there's a shelfing off at more than 45 degrees that takes you down to 20 odd. So yeah, you do not want to be going over there in a hurry. I had 8 fish in the 48 hours that I fished this week, and I'm guessing the deepest one was probably out of about 20 foot, maybe 22 foot, something like that. I was fishing sort of 2 rods along the bank, one in about 12, 14 foot of water, and one in slightly deeper water. I'm guessing it's about 20 foot, yeah. So to me, Bundy sort of slowly warms up in the summer and in the spring, and I think those top layers slowly, well, they're certainly the quickest to warm up. So I think, you know, you're sort of looking April and May, the top 3-4 foot are the warmest, and then towards this time of year, I think the top 20-25 foot are the warmest, and you go all the way down to sort of back end of the summer, and I'm pretty sure it's a uniform depth all the way down to 55 foot, and then things, I'm fairly confident, start to reverse itself around about October, November time, and the top layers tend to be the coldest, and the sort of deepest areas tend to be the warmest. So yeah, it takes a lot to get your head around, really,
Well, perhaps the only thing I actually listened to when I was getting educated, I actually did an A-level in environmental science, and it's a sort of process called thermal stratification. And then, obviously, in autumn, you have the changeover, which you've just accurately described, and then in spring, the same thing in reverse.
Yeah, exactly. And it seems to be on Bundys, it seems to be a strange thing that no matter what the temperature, no matter what the outside temperature is and quite what's happening with the weather, the lake itself seems to do bites up until the first week in January and off the deck, and then it's very, very hard to get a bite off the deck after them. I know you're going to tell me I'm wrong now, aren't you? Because I think you caught one in February, didn't you? Was it February or January?
I know the one from the RAF swim, it was, I believe it was definitely in January, because I remember it's the only January 30 I've ever had.
Nice.
But, you know, the mad thing about that one was it was in ridiculously deep water of 55 plus feet. And I moved on to showing fish.
It's the only lake I've ever fished where you'll see consistent shows in January and February. I mean, they're not as much as what they are now. I mean, you sort of go down there now and 48, if I was watching the water 48 hours, I'd probably see over 100 shows. You know, there's a hell of a lot of fish showing. You know, they're just not shy at all, and they'll just be boshing left, right, and centre, and it's ridiculous how many fish show, and it tends to be periods. They tend to have an hour period or a 2 hour period here, a 2 hour period there, and you can sit up, and if you sit up to 11 o'clock, between 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock in the morning, you can just hear them boshing like crackers, and it's not always in one set area. They can be all over the lake, and you know, I know me and you have had this discussion in the past. Whereas deep water fish tend to show a lot more than shallow water fish.
Yeah, I've certainly found that.
You know, I was talking to my mate Dan on who's fishing down on the south coast, and he's fishing a lake, and I think it's no more than 3 foot, maybe 4 foot. You know, he gets one trouble no matter where he goes. He was saying in there, it's an absolute rarity if they show. But Bundys, Elstow 2, and a few other deep waters that I've fished, you know, the fish is certainly not shy of showing, and, you know, they'll crash all day long. Quite whether why that is, why they feel more comfortable crashing over deep water rather than shallow water, or I just don't know. You know, it could be a way of equalising themselves or getting oxygen through the gills, because there may not be as much oxygen content lower down in the water, or what it is. I just don't know, mate. I don't know why it is, but I just know on deeper waters the fish tend to show a hell of a lot more than on shallow waters.
And the beauty is in shallow waters you can actually get up close and see them.
Yeah,
climbing trees, and you know they that infamous Park Lake, not a million miles from where I am now. You know, I've got some pictures I've taken with my you know, powerful lens on the camera and the polarizing filter of, you know, great big fish, and people are feeding the ducks over the back of them, and it's like, you know, 2 to 3 foot of water.
Yeah, I've got a water lined up that's quite shallow, that hopefully I'll be on pretty soon. And yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to having a crack on that, because it's going to be the polar opposite of what Bund is. It. So yeah, I'm not sure. I've fished shallow waters in the past where you can do that. You sort of get up a tree, and then the sun comes out, the wind stops, and you can just see the whole of your swim. And you just think, there is absolutely nothing in front of me at all. And that can be massively demoralising. Right. And yeah, I like seeing fish, but I can't stand being in a swim that's no fishing. And when you can actually see that fact, it's just completely gutting, and you're just not sure what to do, whether to sort of sit it out and wait for a couple to drift in, or go around chasing them and run the risk of spooking them out and into the next swim with no lines in. So it's a tricky one.
Yeah, it comes back to the watercraft we've just been talking about.
Yeah, it is. And there's a lot said about watercraft and quite what you do. Do you set on fish, or do you set up just off fish, get everything settled, and hope for them to move on to you? And I've done both, to be honest. And I must admit, when I'm setting up on fish, I tend to just flick singles out and try and keep disturbance down to a minimum. You know, try my best to hit. And I must admit, I'm probably the worst angler for doing this. Trying to hit the spot I want first chuck. You know, when everything rides on it, you generally miss, and you think, oh, that could be better. And end up having six casts when really you could have done with three. So that's one of the ways I fish. And if I'm setting up on fish, I will try and just flick singles out. But if I'm there for a length of time and I want to set up a sort of base camp as such and get the fish on bait, then I'll try and set up just off them. And I think a lot of that is down to watercraft, and not just watercraft, but weighing up, right, when this lead hits the water, or when that spot hits the water, what are these fish going to do? Are they in a bay? Are they going to scoot right out of the bay? Or is there some snags at the back of there at the far bank? They're just going to sink into the snags, stay there, and then come out when it's quieting down and come over your baited area, or what they're going to do? And again, it's reading the fish and working out what they're going to do given a said situation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much the same as you. I mean, I look at my carping as match fishing on an extended scale. I mean, your matchman, he'll either fish, you know, with his pole, what they call, like, you know, with a 10 to 2. He'll have two swims out there going. He's baiting the margins. He's pouching, you know, pellets out to a waggler line. And I just like to have not put all my eggs in one basket, but have as many baskets as possible. I'll have, like, other baited spots. If there's, you can get away with it, there's not too many people on the lake, I'll have a couple of baited swims.
Yeah, and that's precisely what I did this week down at Bundes. I went down there and I looked in the snags of this one fish, this one swim I quite like fishing and had a lot of success on in the past, and there was some fish in there. And then I went down to the other corner on the same bank, and there was a lot of fish showing there. In hindsight, I think there was a lot of fish. I think there was a few fish showing a lot, if that makes any sense. I don't think it's as best fish as what it looked like from the shows, because as I set up in there and started watching them, you'd see the same fish come out several times. But I did see one chunk in there. So I thought, right, I'm going to set up in the swamp swim, give it a go and see what happens. So I sort of dropped a bit of kit in that swim. I don't know why, because there was nobody else down there. And went to the other swim and put about 5 kilo of bait out there. I put out some air dries, literally rock solid air dries, just to try and slow them up a little bit. And just think, well, you know, hopefully they won't go in there all guns blazing, just munch these all in, you know, one go. I think I was hoping to take the time a little bit and have a few and take a bit of time crunching them up. But anyway, I dropped in this other swim, did the night in there, had one fish straight away, literally, because they were feeding just off the margins. And I just flicked last week's bait down, had one straight away, 26 pound. And then the following morning, I lost one. I stuck up on Facebook, much to the ridicule of a few mates of mine, when I got a few text messages.
Oh, is that a video you put up?
Yeah, a video I put up.
Yeah, I saw that one.
I was, some people were taking the mix saying I was putting too many fish up there, so I thought, well, I'll put a video of me losing a fish. But I never set the camera up to actually try and video me playing a fish. I was trying to get the video of me getting a fish crashing in the background, because there was certainly a short period there where it was crashing like crazy. And on that video, just as I lost that fish, a fish crashed in the background behind me, which was taking the mick a bit. But then a few really big fish did rock up in the swim, just in the reeds. And they were there for about 2 or 3 hours, but the swans just wouldn't leave them alone. And because a couple of me free offerings had sort of missed the shelf that I was just fishing off, I was fishing tight to the reeds, and actually just gone in the edge of the bulrushes, the swans were just in and out there, and the fish just didn't want to sit there, and Elongo, and they drifted off, and all I could find was a couple of small to medium-sized fish kicking around. So I thought, all right, let's make the most of the baited area that I'd created. So moved around to the other swim about 5 in the evening, just set up on there, quickly got two rods out, bang, bang on the spot. And I was, I'd literally just put about 4 pulpfuls of bait right over the top of them. The rod went off, which surprised me a little bit. And yeah, I had ended up basically with 33 pound fish called Stumpy, which I'd had last summer at 37. So it was a recapture line, but it sort of proved that I made the right decision. And then I caught another one that evening, and then Dawn was just mad. All three rods went within half an hour of each other. One with a 35, and then a couple of mid-20s, and then I had two more a bit later on. So that pre-baited area that I'd done really did pay off for me.
It certainly does, that free feed. You're basically training them to feed on that spot.
Yeah, definitely. And if you can keep the bait going in on one spot when you're not there, and this is why I'm really envious of people that live close to lakes, you know as well as me from travelling around the country, you just can't do it. You're down there for those two nights or longer if you're lucky, and you've just got to make the most of it. So any sort of pre-baiting you're doing, you're pre-baiting for later on in that session and hoping it's not going to hurt you during the current session. You know, you're almost sort of pre-baiting against yourself. But, you know, you've just got to do what you can just to maximise your time that you're on the bank.
Yeah, that's a key word, I think, maximise. Any pre-baiting you're doing between sessions, you're running the risk of pre-baiting for someone else to benefit.
Well, that's it. And, you know, I have done a fair bit of pre-baiting over the time. I've just written an article on it for Cartwheel, actually. And I think there's several forms of pre-baiting. One of them is to get the fish on a certain boilie, you know, especially if you're testing a bait or using a bait that's not that popular on the market. If you want the fish on that bait, the idea is just to put it in all over the lake just to get the fish on it. And I've had absolutely devastating results on that. A few years ago I fished a bait that wasn't on the market yet, and I just put a lot of bait in the water over the course of the summer. And it's probably to detriment to my own fishing, because I was fishing over more bait than what I should have been. But come the autumn, it paid dividends, and to the point where I think I had 23 bites, or to hook 23 fish on three sessions, when there's only about 80 fish in there. And I think the rest of the syndicate had just put together a handful of bites, you know. And that was not purely down to what I was doing, rig wise or spot wise or anything like that. It was purely down to the fish, the fact that I got the fish that switched on and that in tune with the bait, that they were just taking that to the detriment of everything else. You know, and the other forms of pre-baiting I do, you know, when I was on Stoneacre, everybody was just lashing out to the centre because that's where most of the bites were coming from. But a lot of the time, you know, I was sort of walking around the lake, just priming spots right in the edge here and there, because occasionally, if the pressure was down a little bit, the fish would drift into the edge. And I probably had about 12 little spots just in my little notebook about where to bait and, you know, where looked good. And, you know, as I wandered around the lake, if nobody was in that certain corner, couple of handfuls go in that spot and walk around, a couple of handfuls go in that spot, not with any sort of preconceived plan to fish there on day X or day Y, just to sort of drop in there should the fish be there or it look good there. And I must admit, me or a couple of people I let in on the secret caught from those spots, and I'm pretty sure it was down to the fact that the fish could swim around the lake and they'd find bait there on a regular basis and start picking it up without question, really. Whereas if I hadn't done that, you know, the fish would still probably be in the area, but they wouldn't be physically searching that spot for the bait. You know, over the course of sort of a couple of years, I think the fish remember spots where they've seen bait on or seen easy food on it and drop down and feed on it. Well, the sort of other type of pre-baiting is sort of conventional type, where you think, oh, I want to fish there in a week or two's time. Let's go and level out a baiting and then drop on it and see what happens. Yeah, but all three types have done well for me in the past.
Yeah, me too, if I'm honest. Now, I'm just looking at time now. We've been going for well over an hour. I'm going to you know, lead towards a close, but I'm not letting you get away without a couple of questions.
Right, go on then.
Firstly, quite possibly the most important thing in carp fishing, tea or coffee and your favourite biscuits?
Oh, Earl Grey tea.
Oh, you snob.
Tea, definitely. And it's, fortunately, because I've got a dodgy heart these days, it has to be decaf, because caffeine sets it, which nobody carries. So, yeah, I suppose biscuits will be quite boring and say something like rich tea.
Yeah, that is quite... quite
they're a nice dunking biscuit, though, but I am quite open to other biscuits.
Yeah, if you're into dunking, just get on the Hobnobs.
Yeah, I know, but you get too far onto them and then it's just trouble, isn't it? You just end up with a huge waistline. And you can't plant trees anymore, and life just becomes so much more awkward.
Yeah, well, I've grown to about 18 stone and it takes a strong tree to take me nowadays.
Well, I know we're both 40 this year, but I don't know about you, but I'm still climbing trees at every juncture and trying, even though I'm slightly more poorly than what I used to be.
Yeah, I do still try, although I'm careful about the trees I choose.
Yeah, I think these days if we fell out of one, it hurt us a lot more than what it would have done 20 years.
Take a lot longer to get up.
Yeah, saying that, I took my lad fishing the other day, and he's eight. I think it was last summer in the summer holidays. And I said, stay there, mate, I'm just going to get up this tree, see if I can find some fish. I get the stupid questions like, fish aren't in trees, and all this and that. I'm like, yeah, you just stay there.
So I went angler, that does sound ridiculous.
I know it does. You just can't tell non-anglers that. You know, and I can remember, I think I fell out a tree once and did my wrist, and I had to tell everybody at work that. And just, he was climbing a tree to find a fish. Yeah. Anyway, I climbed up this tree, and sort of looking down, looking for these fish. Next thing I know, something touched my foot, and the lad's up this. I'm 30 foot up this tree. My 8-year-old's sort of right up behind me with his hand on my foot. I'm like, you better get down, or your mum's going to kill me if you fall from here. But and later on that session, I let him climb a tree. And just, you know, when you're young, you just see him just rattle these trees, and you just think, God, I wish I could climb a tree like that. But now it's slow and steady, and make sure you've got every branch before you take your foothold off the next one. But yeah, I'm still doing it, mate. I'm still getting up there and trying to find them.
Oh, did you do a risk assessment?
I didn't do a risk assessment. No, I think it would have failed. And to put some warning tape around the tree saying, "Do not climb."
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to do this once, but let's have three tips if you're hunting a big fish, an individual big fish. Well, what would be number one? Your advice.
Yeah, you'll know this one from Fishing the Lady, and it went for the same for Choco, or should I say, it didn't go for the same for either fish. And it's find out the spots that the fish like to be, find out the haunts, find out the little quirks that the fish like, and you'll generally find the fish gets caught from a certain area more often than not. You know, I know when I was on Elstead too, I know the big girl liked to get caught from a few different swims, but I know he liked it from the snag swim, and that's where I ended up catching from in the end. I think it came out of Sunken Island before, and I think it was seen in Terminator. So you'll find that certain fish have got certain haunts and certain areas they do get caught from on a regular basis. It's like the Burfield Common, that was renowned from just coming from the dogleg sort of area, you know, the smallest, windiest bit of the pit, it always used to come from there, right up to the point where Oz had it from sort of semi-open water, and then Dame Leon had it from proper open water, middle of the lake. So that does pay, but obviously with the Fat Lady it didn't work, because the Fat Lady just came from everywhere, as far as I can gather.
Yeah, I think there was a swim on the lake she didn't get caught from at one time.
Yeah, and it was the same with Choco. Choco, on my time on there, never came from the same spot twice. There was only once it came from the same swim twice, and that's when I caught it. But it was from a completely different area. And in order to sort of fish for that fish, you're almost fishing against its past record. And that's on my final year on there, I caught a lot less fish because I was specifically just fishing for that one fish, if that made any sense. I could have dropped it. I could have fish after fish after fish, but I don't think I'd have caught that fish from it. One, because it had come from there. And two, I just didn't fancy it from certain areas. So I was just fishing areas where I knew it hadn't come from, and areas that I'd sort of fancied it might come from. But most other lakes, you'll find that the bigger fish do have certain areas that they do like. So that'll be one sort of tip I'd give people for targeting one fish.
Yeah, do your homework and look at its history.
Exactly, yeah.
So what about number two?
Number two would be just watch and look and search the lake, you know, and get up every single tree you can, especially as the water's clear. Look in every snag, look in every bay. Just look for the fish, you know. If nothing's happening in the edge, just watch open water as much as possible, you know, because that big girl could pop out. You know, you're never 100% sure if it is your target fish, if you've got other fish within, you know, 3, 4, 5 pounds of it. But you can certainly put yourself on big fish, you know. But like I was saying, if the lady comes out, you know it was a lady. You know, there's only the black pig that was near it. And places like Elstow too, you could pretty much pick which fish got crushed, you know, come crashing out of there. I saw the mother come out a few times, and that scaly fish was quite often out of the water.
That fish was an acrobat.
It was, and you could always recognise it because it's the longest fish in there with a big fat arse. It was just, you know, it was just a uniquely proportioned fish.
Yeah, I remember one. I got down there early one morning. Jamie was on the headland swim, and we'd seen Scaly. She'd nutted out maybe about 30, 40 yards out in front of the pipe swim at the other side of the lake.
Yeah.
So I said to Jamie, "I'm over there as soon as I finish this brew."
And then, I know what you're going to say. Yeah. Because I've seen it.
She nutted out at least another 20 times and made her way all the way around the lake.
Yeah. I've seen it do that. When I first saw her, I think she wasn't far off... sort of Terminator. She was around that Terminator pipe sort of swim, and then she came around in front of the carpet, in front of the flatland. She came right in front of Grassy, and last year I saw her in front of Decoy. She did an arc probably about 40 yards out in front of all of them.
Yeah, that's exactly what she did that morning. So I was just like, oh, well, sod you, you're taking the piss.
It's strange how we've both seen that, and, you know, we haven't swapped that story in the past, and it must have been probably 2 or 3 years between you fishing there and me fishing there, but it's you know, she obviously still had the same routine that she used to do occasionally.
That's one thing that lake taught me, is basically individual fish have individual characteristics, traits, habits.
Yeah, I can remember another occasion on there, and I was standing at what we used to call the tarmac viewpoint, and it was in between the Sunken Island and the Decoy, and he was looking from a high bank down onto the fish, and the mother was there, and Scaly was there, and Epilepse were there. It was after the twin had died, and a few of the 18 was there. You know, I was there watching him, and I called Browns over, and me and Browns stood there watching him for a good while. And Stephen Octor was on at the time. I bet you know Steve, don't you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
And his hair.
Yeah, both long-haired Northerners, aren't you? So yeah. You've got a lot in common. So he was round in the back bay, which is completely, you know, for anybody that hadn't been there, completely the opposite side of the lake. He sort of made his way round to us, and by the time he got round to us, he'd come around chatting. And I said, so what are you doing? So, I'm not going to do the accent because I can't do the proper Yorkshire. He basically says, I'm moving around to Back Bay. I says, really? He says, oh, see all those fish down here? He says, yeah, but that sausage is round there. I haven't had that sausage. I quite fancy that fish, which was like a, well, you know, it's like a leathery one with, you know, withered away fins, proper old-looking fish. I says, you what? He says, yeah, the sausage is round there. I've just watched it. It's been swimming around there. I says, Steve, it's there. And he goes, bloody hell. He says, how long has it been there? So it's literally just turned up. So it must have gone. As he walked around the lake, it must have just come straight across the lake and straight into the swim. And again, it just shows you how often these fish move. And it makes you wonder how many times you move on to showing fish. And by the time you got the gear and dropped the gear in the swim, then fish have already gone and they're on, you know, they're halfway around the other side of the lake.
Yeah, I mean, that sausage was a travel. I mean, that was actually my first bite from the lake, first fish out.
Was it?
Yeah, I had the pig, which at the time was low 20s. I think it was not too long after Martin Wassel had caught her.
I think I did 30 on my time on that, the pig.
Two small stockies with her. This was before the Back Bay was dammed off. I got those three feeding in the edge. Repeatedly coming in, feeding. Couldn't catch, couldn't hook one. I got the rod laid on the bank next to me, and I'd almost dozed off till the rod swung round, whacked me one, and I thought it was a sausage. I'd not seen the sausage up till that point. It had just come in, and, you know, with no caution, pig had not warned it, I caught her.
Nice. How big was it then? Because that was quite an old fish, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 24-12 there, but she did make about 33, 34 at tops.
Yeah, I think Brown's had her at 30, 31 it might have been. And then she died a couple of years after I left, so she must have died about 6, 7, 8 years ago, something like that, I don't know. Which was a shame. But did she fight well for you, saying she had no fins and...
Not too bad, but I didn't give him much of a chance. There was quite a lot of reeds around there, even though they were not as thick as what they became.
Yeah, apparently a few people I spoke to reckon she put up a pretty good account of herself, saying, well, she just swam like a snake, didn't she, really? She was very snaky in the water. You couldn't really miss her.
Oh, no, definitely a distinctive fish. I remember once watching Scaly and Epaulettes, which I regular saw together. This is in the snag, so I'm on the top of the cliffs looking down.
Yeah.
And about 2 or 3 feet behind him was the sausage, and whereas Scaly and Epaulettes are swimming along, just gliding along normally, sausage, poor thing, with little stumpy fins, looked like it's putting in some right effort just to keep up.
Yeah, I can imagine. But it was a real character fish, that one. It's a shame I didn't get that one, to be honest.
Yeah, it was, well, the epitome of a character, that one, I think. But anyway, we've done one and two. What about three? What would be your third and final tip?
What's the question again? Oh, targeting big fish.
One, we've got research. Two, we've got just watch, keep your eyes peeled.
I mean, there's one, make sure it exists, because I know a few people that have chased ghosts or big fish that are long gone. You know, I think there's still a few people asking me about Choco these days and asking me about, you know, the big fish at Swarkston, and the rumours that's still kicking around. But, you know, the chances are, if they've gone missing for that sort of length of time, no one's seen them, no one's caught them. You know, it's a different story with fish like the mother or some of the fish from Bundy's that go on the missing list for a while and then all of a sudden rock up. But when you've got fish that are coming out two or three times a year, every year, and they've gone missing for 3-4 years, you think they ain't around anymore. Yeah, so it's,
I've known fish that, you know, very rarely come out, change to 1, 2, 3 times a year, but not the other way around.
Yeah, it's I mean, Bundy's is renowned for fish going on the missing list, and you know, it's just done its late record mirror at 43, and that fish has not been out for 22 months. It's other mate, the other big mirror, which is generally 2 or 3 pounds bigger than that. That's not been out for even longer, I think. And there's quite a few fish. You know, a fish I had back in the last year got a hole in the dorsal. I think that went missing for best part of 3 years, a few years previous and whatnot. So the fish do it a lot, but you need to be honest with yourself and sort of think, is that fish really in here? Was that fish ever in here? Because I know a few people that have gone off chasing dreams and chasing these uncaught whackers. And no doubt there is waters around that do hold uncaught fish. Just make sure that the fish you're after is, one, exists in the first place and not just some rumour of a bailiff stirring up rumours for whatever reason, whether to line his own pocket or you know, just to cause a bit of trouble, or, you know, whether he's just hopeful rather than knowledgeable. So make sure it exists in the first place. Two, if it has been caught in the past and you have seen photographs of it, make sure it is that weight and you know, it is in there for a start, because a lot of the time fish are getting mixed up from water to water, you know, and people throw in blinds and stuff, you know, catching a stunning fish from a water that's on the quiet, and then when the sort of cat's gone out of the bag that this one's from, say, Cambridge way, they're saying it's from the popular lake next door or something like that. So make sure that fish is actually there for one reason or another, and make sure it's still there would probably be my third tip.
Yeah, that's a good one. I know, do recall someone who I'll not name, actually fishing Long Reach after seeing a picture of paddle that used to live in the wool pack.
Really?
Throwing blinds on him, yeah. It does happen, but
it does happen quite a lot, especially around in Cambridgeshire pits. And I won't name any waters, but there's been a few where fish are said to be in there, and this is said to be in there. And in all truth, after a good length of time, nothing's really rocked up.
Who knows? It's that romanticism of chasing the unknown that it does drive a few of us on. I've been on wild goose chases, but
yeah,
I'm in the middle again.
If you've got good anglers on there for 3, 4, 5 years and the fish ain't still ain't been out, that ain't going to get caught. You know, I remember Fan Drayton in the early days with these, with this stripy common, a fish that Jim had, a fish we used to call Scaly. There's a fish called a wrecking ball, you know, or the big grey or slate grey or whatever it was called. Some of them did exist, but they just weren't going to get caught. You know, I saw, as I just said earlier in this piece, I saw the one that Jim had. And that was 3 years after he had it, and that hadn't been out since. You know, there's a lot of talk about this big slate grey one. I saw that feeding the edge, and there was nothing else that could have been. It was an absolute wrecking ball of a fish. You know, I drifted past it on a boat. It was feeding in about 18 inches of water, and I clearly saw it from the side. I think that's a damn good 30, that one is. And then it turned head on to me, and it was almost as wide as it was deep, and it was just round. It was really thick set across the shoulders, and I instantly put another £10 on that fish's weight, and that fish has never been caught. And you know, I saw a few others, and so no doubt these big, sometimes mythical fish do exist, but I think it's only a small percentage of the rumours that are actually true. And then when you get waters that's so natural rich like Fen Drayton, they don't always switch onto boilers, or certainly not for a long, long period of time. So the chances of catching them are pretty remote. Just be a little bit careful when you're fishing waters with these so-called lumps in. They might be there. But there's also a very good chance they might not be as well.
Reliable catch reports, or actually see them with your own eyes.
See them with your own eyes, or somebody you can trust. Yeah. Not my mate's brother's son had this one. And, you know, you see some sketchy picture of somebody holding it down by the knees and you think, that could be anything, you know, and you can't see any background or anything like that. So I normally like to see a photograph, at least, preferably with a photograph with a bit of recognisable background in, where you think, yeah, that's from there, that's definitely from there. And then just hope it's not been relocated, because that's another problem you get with these sort of hush-hush out-the-way places. And I know, even now, I know a few fish that have certainly been shifted around a little bit.
Yeah, that is certainly frowned upon, and because of that, it's kept a lot quieter nowadays. But I do remember a lake I used to fish up near Doncaster, Thorpe Marsh Power Station. Half the 20s in there were named after the lake they were nicked from.
Yeah, you do see lakes around the country that are sort of wanted membership but have publicity bans on, and you sort of wonder why, and then you dig deeper into it and it says, well, yeah, they're not entirely sure where this fish might have come from, you know. And I'm not blaming current owners or anything like that, but sometime in the distance past, fish X might have been moved from water Y into water Z, and you just think,
yeah. Yeah, and then people go fishing for him and shout keep it real at the same time. It's
yes, sometimes a fish being moved is a mercy if a lake's getting filled in, which I think happened at was it Waverley back? No, not Waverley. Yeovil back in the day. Yeah, Yeovil, that's the one. And stuff like that, you know, if it's saving these fish's lives and moving into a water where there's next to no fish anyway, you know, in my eyes, that's fine. But if people are moving fish from one water to another stocked water, for no reason except for the personal gain, then that's a big wrong for me.
It's a theft, by the end of the day.
And, you know, I don't want to go into too much detail about some of the waters we've mentioned previously, but I'm pretty sure that some of the fish that I've been fishing for ain't been in that water anymore. And, you know, I found out a year or two sort of after I've been going for them. They might not have been my main target fish, but they're probably a sort of, you know, second target fish, or I certainly won't mind that one, and that one's probably a bit more catchable. And then to find out they've grown legs and moved on a bit later on is not the one in my eyes, especially nicking from established fisheries. That's completely below the belt.
It certainly is. Well, anyway, on that note, I think we have been going long enough, and I know we can probably double this as well, where we can talk. But so again, it was a short notice. I want to thank you for doing this, Ed, and it's been an enjoyable chat. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it's always good chatting to you as usual, pal. And I'll catch you in the bank sometime.
Well, that certainly got me thinking about one or two things over that chat with Ed. And as I said earlier on, the next episode of the Carpcast is going to be a cracker. It's going to be our 10th birthday, our 10th episode, which, for a young podcast like us, it's a bit of a milestone, and we're looking forward to it. We've got quite a bit of news to cover and get updated with on the net. We've got 2 weeks to get it all right, do our research. And before I finish, I've just got to take care of a bit of business. The Carpcast is free for you all to listen to, but unfortunately, not free for us to produce. So we'd like a little bit of help with our production costs, and you can do this by clicking on our Amazon link. Anything you buy from Amazon after clicking our link doesn't cost you a single penny more, but Amazon rolls a few pennies our way. And as they say, every little helps. There is also advertising space available on the Carpcast. So let me tell you how that works. There is around a minute's audible advert at the beginning of our podcast, and this can be written by us and recorded by us. It can be written by you, recorded by us, or written and recorded by you and sent to us, and we will put it in. We will also put your link to your Facebook page, your website, or whatever in the description of our podcast. What we are finding with podcasts is people are discovering them new, they're listening to the latest episode, and then they are going back and listening to the older ones when they see a guest they may like. Your advert will be there, and it will be listened to forever. So, thanks again for listening. See you next time.